Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Last week, we started the Legal Eagle franchise series with Michael Webster, franchise attorney and chairperson of the Strategic Committee at the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Michael and I spoke about independent franchisee associations, franchise advisory councils, and of course the upcoming convention for the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. You know, the segment is available on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. I'd like to extend my thanks to Michael as he cleared the air for many, including me, about the role of independent franchisee associations in franchising today. Hey, speaking of thanks, I have to thank Joe Caruso once again for his assistance in co-producing our legal series. You know, it's funny how a simple conversation evolves into thoughts and ideas and actually propels itself to a concept and then on to something much bigger. That's exactly what happened in a series of conversations with Joe that formed the foundation of the Legal Eagle franchise series. From there, we developed topics we felt were of interest to franchise professionals across various industry segments. Most importantly, we wanted to be certain the topics were relevant in franchising today. And today's topic, as do all four of our topics in this series, fit the bill to a T. And franchise performance representations, or as they're commonly known as FPRs, are something that this week's guest, Lane Fisher, knows quite well. Now, next week, the series continues as I'll be joined by Warren Lee Lewis, a partner in franchising and licensing at Ackerman Centerfeet. You know, Warren and I will be discussing franchise sales best practices as we dive into his great publication, The Franchise Seller's Handbook. Be sure to listen next week as well, and I'll be certain to let you know how to get a copy of Warren's handbook. Then the series concludes the following week with Play Cook's Leslie Curran. This should be another interesting segment of Franchise Today, as the discussion will focus on the pros and cons of using franchise brokers. I think it would be great having a legal perspective on a topic that always to be seen as one of the most on the minds of franchisors as they try to build momentum in franchise development after what we know has been a lackluster 2 years. In addition, Leslie's going to provide us with an overview of the IFA's legal symposium as well as some insight into the Women's Franchise Network. So be sure to join me and these bright legal minds on Franchise Today every Thursday right into the Memorial Day weekend for the Legal Eagle franchise series. Now, as we announced last week, my new internet radio show, Franchise News Radio, will debut on Wednesday, June 2nd. More information will be provided as the date draws near. In the meantime, be sure to follow the new show on Twitter. The profile is at Fran News Radio. There really has been some interesting activity in the LinkedIn franchise groups. You know, one discussion, has anyone ever seen a franchisor that has sold franchises without an open, operating, and successful company-owned location? Has over 50 responses in the franchise executives group alone. There's some great responses and a few that may encourage you to participate and give your opinion. You know, speaking of opinion, I posted an opinion poll within the LinkedIn franchise groups regarding today's topic. You know, the poll question, after some reluctance, recent trends see franchisors providing FPRs in their FDDs. Do you consider FPRs friend or foe? Has seen a lot of franchise professionals responding. As of showtime a few minutes ago, over 77% voted that FPRs are in fact a friend, while 9% said FPRs are a foe, and the remaining 14% were undecided. I'd be curious to see if today's show changes some opinions. It'll certainly be interesting, but probably not as interesting as today's guest, Lane Fisher. Lane is a partner at Fisher Zucker, LLC, and is a member of the IFA Board of Directors and its Franchise Business Network Task Force. He's a frequent speaker at franchise conferences, has written extensively on franchise-related issues, and has appeared on several TV news shows. For over 17 years, Lane has represented franchisors in business transactions and complex litigation, including matters related to trademark, copyright infringement, franchise development, and regulatory issues. He has also litigated the enforcement of franchise agreement obligations on behalf of franchisors. Lane, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
That's my pleasure. Lane, I have to say, I love your perspective on franchise matters, which seems to have the perfect blend of direct legal interpretation and sound business insight. I'm sure that's a result of a degree in finance, a law degree, and an MBA in international business. Now, I've only spoken to you a short time in the past days as we prepared for today's show, but I can tell you that it seems to me that you really do have a passion for franchise success, and it certainly appears to reach well beyond the legal aspects of franchising. Why is that? Why such a passion?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, doing this as long as we have, there are certain sort of best practices that emerge and work for lots of different companies. And sort of as a person that has the ability to combine all this information and compile it and sort of interpret it, we, I think, get a sense of what works from a business sense as well, or what's worked for other people, which makes us a little bit more well-rounded in our advice. But I appreciate you saying that. Those are kind words, and we actually pride ourselves in trying to be business people and business lawyers, not just, you know, lawyers to find fault with what's before us.
Right, absolutely. Well, it's always nice when somebody walks the walk and talks the talk, and it's nice seeing somebody as passionate about franchise success. You know, franchising as we know it has been around for quite a while. I mean, we know the IFA recently celebrated in San Antonio its 50th anniversary, and we know that, you know, up to the late 70s, there was some conflicting opinions on whether or not franchising was, you know, a sound business model, as well as some opinions on how this business model of franchising should be governed. I guess, you know, to provide a backdrop for today's discussion on financial performance representations, can you please give us a little bit of historical insight on the evolution of franchise regulation, including where we are today?
Sure. I think the first franchise law emerged in California in and around 1971, and I think it was more precipitated by how folks were selling franchises and what they were saying to people in connection with selling franchises than anything else. And then various other states started to adopt their own policies, and what happened was there became a non-standardized and very sort of state-subjective way and methodology in providing disclosure, which is typically what these laws provided for. And in 1979, the FTC, in an effort to try to sort of level the playing field for franchisors transacting business nationally, adopted the Federal Trade Commission rule on franchising. Now, specifically, it didn't override or overrule state laws, and in fact provides for them to regulate more onerously if they choose to in the state. And so the FTC rule is really, is a disclosure statute. It doesn't have a right of action, meaning people can't sue under it, but the state-specific laws that exist, and I think there are 15 and there may be more, depending on whether you have exemptions from other state laws, you know, are in that vein.
Interesting.
So, you know, the FTC rule sort of went along, and it had been amended along the way, but principally, earnings claims, which is our topic today, were regulated. There was a certain methodology under which you had to provide the information if you were, rather than sort of saying exactly what it was. They sort of defined it as any information from which you could define or ascertain a level of earnings, profits, or even costs under the old rule. In 2008, the FTC rule was amended, and frankly, the earnings claim, the nomenclature was changed, so now they're called financial performance representations. And the most significant change is cost information is not an earnings claim, and geographic relevance, which was a thing that franchisors put forth as an objection to why they couldn't make earnings claims, has been removed. And just by way of background, the motivation behind it, and I hear other lawyers sort of describe, or other people describe it as the regulators don't like earnings claims. And in fact, the regulators would like to make them mandatory because they think the information is so critical to franchisees. So, you know, there's a sort of dated, somewhat dated in my view, or a modern view of it, and we're certainly on the modern side.
Right. You know, it seems we always need some clarification on terms. So for the sake of this show, is it okay that we consider as synonymous the terms earnings claims and franchise performance representations and FPRs?
Yeah, financial performance representations. I'll understand that that's what we're talking about, and to the extent that there's a new answer under the new rule, I'll point that out.
Right. Yeah, I guess I did say franchise performance representations. I apologize. Yes, financial performance representations. You know, personally, I believe it's imperative franchisors make a financial performance representation or earnings claim. You know, why do you think some franchisors, you know, might have a general reluctance to make earnings claims? And do you see that the trend is changing, that franchisors are beginning to embrace earnings claims a little bit more?
I think that there is a trend to franchisors embracing them more. As to the reluctance or recalcitrance to do it in the past, I think people just believe that as soon as you put numbers in front of a franchisee, you're somehow going to be responsible for the franchisee achieving those numbers. And they're not really recognizing that this sort of safe harbor, if you will, revolves around your presentation of historical data, which, you know, exists, and which, if you give the proper, you know, document your assumptions appropriately, don't become a projection of what the franchisee would do. But I still hear people say they fear that a franchisee will embrace it, will immediately assume if they present mature store volumes that they'll open doing mature store volumes. And they really, in some cases, believe that the best information will come from franchisees and send them out calling existing franchisees to gather that information themselves. But those people that have adopted it all report a shorter selling cycle. They report a shortening of due diligence, and the franchisees are merely verifying information rather than trying to develop it. And I think a large part of the movement toward them being more adopted in greater proportion is that the sales process has grown and become much more sophisticated and has sort of much more players in it. And to the extent people use brokers, and I know that's the topic of another show, or have an extensive sales team or operations folks meeting with prospects, that they recognize that by providing an earnings claim, they provide a backdrop to the prospect against which they can measure the information that they get either internally from franchisors people or from franchisees who may choose to call the two biggest franchisees and get a lot of information that's not entirely relevant to their startup. So at least if the information is presented, you have a tool and a backdrop, and frankly in litigation where we see this sometimes come up, it makes it difficult to argue that you relied on the napkin when you had, you know, this well-documented earnings claim or financial performance representation in your offering documentation.
So I guess the days of franchisors telling a candidate, oh, we're not allowed to give an earnings claim, is quickly falling by the wayside.
Yeah, that actually angered the examiners. They would say we're legally not allowed to do it. And in fact, under the new rule, you have to make a conspicuous statement that obviously acknowledges your ability to do it and your voluntary choice not to, rather than this fictional, you know, it's illegal.
Right. Now, can you just, as we're moving a little bit away from the historical side of it, can you give me a little bit of insight into some exemptions from the franchise registration and disclosure requirements? Because I know some of the listeners have had some questions that they've sent me before saying, well, I understand there are certain exemptions. What specifically are they?
You mean, are you talking about the large franchisee exemption?
I believe that's what they were asking about, yes.
Well, there's certain franchisees of a certain size and deals of a certain size and transactions with insiders that have experience working for the franchisor under certain circumstances are exempt. It doesn't actually come up that much in real practice in our experience, but the exemptions do exist, and I don't think there's a lot of interpretive guidelines or other information under them.
Right. So really, it really doesn't apply to the masses.
It doesn't. I mean, if franchisors were getting prospects that were of this degree of financial wherewithal, I think they'd be very happy. But I think that for the regular folks who are, you know, solicited through ordinary means, they're probably not going to satisfy the exemption. But, you know, certainly if you have a specific case and you have and you believe it may qualify, you should certainly look for that. Now, the other exemption is a franchisor's exemption in certain registration states if the franchisor has a certain net worth or net asset value. And that varies by state, but essentially would provide that the franchisor need not register before selling franchises in that state. And typically those exemptions require some kind of notice.
Okay. Well, the person that had sent me that question, I hope they're listening and got that answer. You know, I've observed, especially recently, a trend in franchise advertising. You know, obviously for franchise candidates, particularly in the Wall Street Journal, where franchisors and some of their agents are making FPRs right in the advertisement. For instance, it might be, you know, average unit sales of $1 million or something along those lines. What are the actual requirements for FPRs in an advertisement in a publication like the Wall Street Journal?
Well, the answer is if you have an FPR, you can report information which is contained in the FPR in your advertising. There's certain sort of required notices that go along with it, and obviously, you know, if it precipitates questions, you have to get them into the FPR itself. But in advertising, and you see lots of folks do it, where they talk about even not only average sales, but frankly, the top-performing sales. They look at different strata or different footprints like an inline or a kiosk, and they present that information, which you're permitted to do under the new rule. The only time you can't do it is if you don't have an FPR, then you can't do it. But if you have an FPR and the information you're presenting is consistent with the FPR, you can use it in your own franchise solicitation advertising.
Okay. You know, as I often preach, when a franchisor, you know, starts in the world of social media, development of a strategy is essential. I mean, it's a key component. And I think the same is true in developing a franchise, a financial performance strategy. You know, what are the things franchisors should consider when developing an FPR strategy?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I think that it may start with what information the company or its salespeople think is important to highlight to differentiate your brand or the success associated with your brand. And I think too many times the lawyers and the higher-ranking folks sort of decide what's going to go in there without debriefing their staff as to what they'd like to actually present. So, you know, we always like to find look at the sales process, see what information the salespeople find is worthwhile, and then figure out if there's a way to present that in a way that they could just simply use it. The second thing to consider is, you know, what available data you have. Some franchisors collect no data, and they think that's the end of the day, so that they can't, you know, present any earnings claims. But, you know, what we have found is that you can accomplish through surveys and through other means, you can actually collect the information and present it. So, and frankly, if your strategy includes presenting the information, you should probably collect it going forward in some way which is reliable. And then sort of the third strategy is the information you'll present and how you'll present it, and sort of whether you'll show units growth over periods of time, whether you'll show particular unit volume. A lot of times, especially as the economy has changed and franchisors have sort of tried to introduce either new services or new products or new pieces of equipment, we've used earnings claims to demonstrate essentially, you already know the cost of the equipment, but essentially the revenue associated with that particular service or piece of equipment in a way that helps the company justify the cost of such things. I'm sure there's other reasons and other things people consider. I don't think, my personal preference is I don't like to just present the top operators, even though you can. I think that you're trying to measure and give people expectations so that they validate going forward and their expectations are consistent with what happens. So I like to show less mature, like stores 1, 3, and 5 years old, or some which show the growth in unit volume over those year periods, so that the franchisee can see over a relatively short period of time that they can realize a decent return on their investment. You know, some of these other things, these non-annual gross sales type earnings claims would include like average ticket prices, your closing ratio for a salesperson that's out trying to sell a particular service, we talked about average ticket, and we talked about the number of patients somebody sees, the number of students in a particular class, and showing growth in those things, again, puts your opportunity in a favorable light, and that's really what you're often trying to do in developing your strategy.
Right. So from the perspective of a layman as opposed to a legal expert, mm-hmm. you know, what are the, the reasonable basis standards for making an FPR?
I mean, they have to have a reasonable basis, which means that when you look at it, if you know that the results are atypical of what your franchisees today are experiencing, I don't think you can put it out there. So you have to identify sort of atypical results. It doesn't have to be audited or anything like that. You can just compile or collect the data, using the information you collect or the reports you collect and or surveys. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yeah, no, I think that's I think the listeners will like it from that perspective. You know, what do you say to franchise clients? And I know you look at it a little bit differently because, as I said at the top of this, you look at it from the business perspective as well as from the legal perspective, which is really a nice shining light on it because franchisors do need to look at it from a business perspective as well. What do you say to franchise clients who believe they can't make an earnings claim or are hesitant to do so?
I mean, I think you try to explain the actual state of the law, and there's you can find publications and other information on various sites which are consistent with the interpretation that we're suggesting. People don't usually need us to explain to them that they're trying to be competitive and like in a situation where folks are in a broker network. So, for example, the broker networks have a much higher incidence of franchisors who make earnings claims because in a broker network world where you're referring multiple opportunities to a prospect, you don't want to stand out as the only one that doesn't have an earnings claim. So you really are almost forced in order to remain competitive to actually have one. And people, that adds up pretty fast to folks. And also, many of them see their competitors adopting it, and they find themselves selling against published earnings claims, and a lot of times believe their results are better and want to be able to engage in a discussion about that. And so, it's the invisible hand of, it usually brings folks around. There's no one way to do it, and you don't have to go and present annual sales information. You don't have to go and work them down to net income. You can present, most of our clients, for example, present gross sales information and then present like the largest categories of expenses, maybe the top three or four, but don't get down to cell phones and health insurance because of, sometimes there's some clutter in those categories that may not be replicated by the next guy.
Sure. So there's certainly a lot of flexibility and room for a little bit of uniqueness, I guess. So what are some of the unique ways you've observed franchisors actually making FPRs?
Well, let me back up because I want to complete my other answer for one second. The interesting byproduct of the earnings claim discussion is always an interesting conversation about benchmarking. And while franchisees don't necessarily have an interest in wanting their information compiled so the franchisor can sell more franchises, they do have an interest in getting back worthwhile and reliable benchmarking data. So a lot of times you can get buy-in to the metrics that matter that make it, frankly, a win-win for everybody who's participating and, frankly, show where the system might have strengths. And through this exercise, a lot of franchisors have identified strengths that they either didn't know they had or that sort of came as part of the process. And so if your selling system is such that you have a higher closing rate or have a high closing rate, presenting your closing rate in your earnings claim would be a worthwhile thing to present, and it wouldn't necessarily suggest an annual level of gross sales. It really is what are the attributes of the business which help to show it in the most favorable light, and then what universe you're going to look at, and then trying to essentially present that information. Sometimes
it really does the franchisor the motivation to look at this from a business standpoint, and it actually helps them from a business standpoint in evaluating what they're good at.
Well, and what you'll find is the top operators in the system are usually very competitive, and they want to know what best practices have emerged elsewhere in the system, and they want to be the best. And so by presenting that data, you can really light a fire under folks that are already good operators, and continue to grow the benchmarking data and grow the results by sharing those best practices. So yeah, I think that the benchmark, if you don't engage in the benchmarking exercise post the FPR preparation, then I think you're missing half the boat, if not more. Because it's one thing to pull the information out of somebody, particularly if you don't otherwise collect it. It's another thing to create an information sharing policy where folks get access to each other's data.
Right, absolutely. So have you observed any unique ways that franchisors are making earnings claims?
Yeah, I've tried to describe a few during this call. I think that with respect to particular pieces of equipment or particular services that somebody might add, and they might have to make an equipment investment up front to get it, evaluating the income associated with that additional service, cost justifies it. And so folks are using it for that purpose. Folks are using it to demonstrate things like how productive referral sources are, or with frequency with which people get a haircut, for example, or what their average ticket is for a haircut, the degree to which customers return for repeat business, all of which you can imagine in most any businesses, if you had favorable data points, would be certainly good information for the salespeople to share with prospects.
Anytime there's and it seems like the new rule allows a little bit more subjectivity to developing the earnings claim as different from the old rule.
I think the principal distinction is it lets you present subsets without sort of presenting the whole franchise community. Because when you're compelled to present the whole community, you're sometimes presenting results from legacy stores that are nowhere near or nothing like what you're essentially offering today as a franchise. And frankly, the less relevant is to what you're offering today, it obviously distorts the results because it's including operating performance from units that are not consistent with the franchisor's today's selection criteria.
Do you have any advice for franchisors that try to get a little bit too creative?
Yeah, I don't think this is a place to demonstrate sort of how off the wall you can be. I think I don't think your sales process should be off the wall. I think that in a sales process, you're trying to talk about a business in terms of its hopefully positive attributes. And I think in developing those attributes and the level and extent to which they might be combined with other attributes like average ticket and number of patients, let's say, that get you to an earnings claim, the people need to think that stuff through and make sure that information ends up in an earnings claim. If food cost is for somehow a really important item for you, that you don't just express it as a percentage, unless you have it in your earnings claim in terms of the actual numbers, which then break out to a percentage. So, I'm not a fan of risk, and I'm a pretty cautious person, so I wouldn't go crazy on it, especially to start. But I think that debriefing your salespeople about what tools might help them be more effective salespeople is really a great starting point, and then analyzing whether those data points are earnings claims and then whether they need to be added to the document is sort of the next stage of it.
Right. Well, it's my understanding that the franchisor must have written...
Written what? Hello?
Guess we have a moment of silence. Lane, are you there? I guess we're having some technical difficulties. I seem to have lost Lane, and this is the Franchise Today Show. My name is Paul Segretto. We're talking today about FPRs with Lane Fisher of Fisher Zucker, and I guess we're experiencing some difficulties, and we're trying to determine if we have a connection. Lane, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we got a little bit of technical difficulties, and I lost you.
Yeah, in the middle there, you were in the middle of a very articulate and bright observation, and somehow you dropped off. So I'm back. I'm sorry about that.
I guess I was talking about, I said, it's my understanding that a franchisor must have written substantiation in his files for any FPRs. And I also know that on reasonable request by a prospect, a franchisor must share that backup information. What type of backup information does a franchisor need to have?
Well, I'll tell you, what we find is there's typically layers of information, starting with raw data, which ultimately is combined, usually electronically, into various forms of spreadsheets. And there may be a number that are preliminary in terms of analyzing the universe in terms of how you're breaking the information down. But we typically, as we conclude and prepare the earnings claim, we use a final form of spreadsheet, which is generally setting forth the data that we're presenting. And we usually bind that up in a form that can be maintained as it needs to be with franchisors. But it's not giving people, a survey result from a single individual, in my view. And, in my experience, very few people have ever asked for the substantiating documentation unless and until, they've been terminated or they're looking at other avenues. But I've seen, actually, I don't recall anyone ever asking for it before they bought the substantiating documentation piece.
Yeah, certainly those are the type of things that rise up and try to bite you after the fact, right?
Well, the fact is the person who compiled it or who worked with the lawyers on preparing it may no longer be there. And so people, the folks who will ultimately be responsible to stand behind the earnings claim need to have, it's not just as a matter of being compliant with the law, but so that they're prepared to answer questions going forward and they can tell what, so that the assumptions in terms of what units were or were not looked at are carefully documented so somebody can go recreate those steps and demonstrate that the franchisor was diligent and reasonable in its financial performance representation.
Is there any specific fact as to what percentage of franchisors have earnings claim today as opposed to, let's say, 5 years ago?
Yeah, the number has always been reported at or around between 18 and 20%. In like 2007 and maybe 6, as so many more new franchisors came on that had no operating history, I think it sort of kept that percentage down. I would say I think that the more recent data is upwards of 30 or 35%, and in the broker networks, I think it's more like 70 or 75%. So it's, much more folks, and if you just look at the numbers of franchisors in terms of the new startups versus ones that are actively engaged in the franchise business, I think you'd see that the percentage goes up. And certainly as the economy is soured and people, the prospect's perception might be that the results have worsened, that those people have, wanted to make sure that to the extent that they've not worsened or they've improved, that they have that best foot forward.
Sure. It's interesting to note that the percentages that you just related to us fall very closely in line with the poll that we did regarding FPRs being friend or foe, where 77% as of the beginning of this show have said that FPRs are a friend, and of course the balance have been said that it was a foe or they're undecided. So it is interesting that those percentages seem to have fallen in line.
Here's an interesting observation. In a lawsuit involving a franchisor that doesn't have an FPR, there's almost 100% certainty that lawsuit will include a claim of an illegal FPR. And in lawsuits involving systems that have financial performance representations, that the incidence of those sort of bad financial performance representation claims is dramatically lower. That doesn't mean that somebody couldn't mess it up in the process or that somebody couldn't attack somebody's basis or their substantiating documentation. But it's just been unlikely.
Sure. Some, as we know, there are some franchisors and they're, whether it be internal or external salespeople, think that since they have an item 19, it basically gives them freedom to say anything in addition to what is in the actual claim. How do you recommend that franchisors guard against this practice, especially when they're talking about external salespeople?
Well, I mean, I think that sort of goes to this question I raised initially about debriefing your salespeople in terms of what they need to say, because you're dead right that they can't exceed what it says in the FPR, and to the extent they do, or even more significantly, give the prospect any statement or belief that they adopt those numbers when they're prepared for the prospect, is a bad thing and puts the salespeople at risk. I think that you're right, though. When people have them, they kind of think it gives them the green light to say whatever they want, and it doesn't at all. It's a very not narrow, but it's limited in terms of what you choose to say. And folks that overstate it are going to find themselves, you know, just like making an illegal one. It's just outside of the scope of the documentation.
Sure. Well, you know, with respect to social media, and this is something you and I were talking about just as the show started. There have been, you know, many FPRs within social media activity, at least that I've observed, especially over the past year, as social media has become, you know, more mainstream and franchisors are trying to recover from a bad economic time where franchise sales were down. And I believe some in this relatively new arena may have been some of the FPRs may have been, you know, inadvertent or even accidental earnings claims. But I know some have been intentional. Some may have been passed off as accidental. Do you have any thoughts about earnings claims specifically within social media?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with your observation that people kind of view it as a statement made into, like, hyperspace and not somehow made to a particular person, and they may think that absolves them from liability. They may observe franchisees making similar postings about their own performance, which, frankly, may be totally permitted under our Constitution. But making a financial performance representation in social media can be just like making any other one. The issue is, to whom is it made? Are they a prospect? Are they a person to whom you'd make these? Of course, if they buy one from you, ultimately buy a franchise from you, they will, in fact, have been a prospect because they actually consummated the sale. But I think that people are more careless on Facebook or in these other sort of web-based forums, and it all ties back. You know, it's all tied to an individual who made the statement, and in some cases, the individual whose name is associated with it isn't the person making the posting. So it's, you got to kind of be careful.
Right, and careful is definitely a key word, because unlike an improper FPR that may be made verbally, the internet lasts forever, and if it's there in black and white, somebody's going to find it. And as you said, that is often the case after the fact, when a franchisee might be terminated or looking to get out of their franchise agreement, is when they usually raise their ugly head and say, we received an improper earnings claim.
Yeah, that's right. I think people also perceive that those things are not permanent, because they, you know, the discussion will reset, or there'll be 800 discussions in front of it. But we know with all things electronic, there's a paper trail that leads back to the ultimate.
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know, and you're probably aware, you know, many of the new franchisors that are out there listen to Franchise Today. We get as many as 2,000 to 5,000 on-demand listens over the weekend, and we are a relatively small community. You know, I'd like to be sure that they understand that there is some risk in providing improper FPRs and consequences too. So, you know, as well, for the experienced agents that feel they can play fast and loose and seem to thumb their noses at following rules. In terms of litigation, what have you observed in regard to risk and consequence that you might be able to share with our listeners?
Well, you know, I mean, first and foremost, these state statutes I referred to earlier, which are referred to as sort of little FTC acts, often those have not only the law, what you have to say, but also have remedies in terms of what happens if you breach them. And usually there's a substantial fine, and, you know, all sorts of bad things can happen to you. In Illinois, there's, I think, even some criminal consequences depending on what it is that you say outside of the statute. The FTC rule itself provides for remedies, but it's really a tool for the FTC to initiate enforcement actions. There's, you know, obviously limited resources, but there are certainly published opinions of where the FTC went, you know, after folks and had them, you know, again pay substantial fines based on each occurrence and, you know, and agree to never do it again and or agree never to sell in a particular state again. So you really got to take it seriously. Now, I mean, for some new franchisors have obviously a limited operating history, and to the extent that you have some, you know, it depends on what that operating history is. My experience is that prospects and franchisees would like to have it, even if it was only one or two locations in a particular geography, rather than not have it. And so, and the law provide, you know, is you're able under the law to provide that information as long as you provide all the limitations of it. And a franchisee in receiving that information needs to consider the limitations of it. And, you know, in all cases, recognize that their actual success is really a function of their own business acumen and skill, the level and extent to which they follow the franchisor's policies and procedures, their, you know, how well they operate their business, how diligent they are, how good their real estate they select is, and all the other factors that the franchisor can't possibly know going into it.
Right, and certainly we know ignorance is not a very good defense, right?
Yeah, I don't think ignorance is going to do much for anybody.
Definitely not going to help. So to you new franchisors out there, talk with your counsel, find out if you're doing it correctly, and heed their advice.
I mean, the new franchisors are the ones that may be in most need of demonstrating their financial performance, you know, and so it really is, it's not just the thing of, okay, we shouldn't do it. I mean, you should have some reasonable operating history, and you should believe that the results are replicatable or representative. But, you know, many of our and other people's startup clients offer some form of financial performance representation. Yet you've got to be careful that you don't look at a store that's or a location that's been around for 20 years and assume that that's going to be like a year one sales volume. But as long as you state all the limitations, you know, you can present that information. It may impact how extensively what information you'll present and how deep you'll go, but there's definitely some information you can present.
Yeah, and I know, you know, looking at, I know there's some franchisors that I've spoken with, new franchisors, that are in the state of California, and I know California is pretty extreme in remedies to earnings claim violations with, you know, potentially treble damages. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine of $100,000 per violation and punishable by up to a year. Oh, wait, no, am I reading the right place? Yes, in California. Damages and rescission claims. So yeah, I mean, not and the irony about California, or the part that I think people don't typically recognize, is it's not just the franchisor president. It's anybody who is involved in making the illegal claim. So it could very well implicate franchise salespeople and other folks who may lack the means to satisfy a fine like this. But I think people are shocked that it actually reverberates back to, you know, real folks.
I know a lot of people, a lot of new ones, when I relay that to them, they say, nah, that's just an extreme case. That would never happen. Well, you heard it here. It can happen.
Right.
So, you know, I know you have a finger on the pulse of franchising. What are your observations on state franchising, and what are some of the most daunting challenges ahead?
What do you mean by state franchising?
The state of franchising in general. What do you see as some of the daunting challenges ahead for franchising?
Well, Paul, I mean, I think you couldn't possibly not mention the changes, obviously, to the financing world. And, you know, if any one single fact has influenced franchisors, certainly, or perhaps two, the downfall in the economy and the, you know, evaporation of financing sources for franchise investment. So, and I think we have a whole lot of veterans coming home. We have an administration in Washington that must find a solution for small business financing, and I think franchising will be a beneficiary of it. I'm sort of still confident that we'll because I'm seeing sources of financing emerge now, and I'm seeing certainly the better qualified folks now having access, and it trickling down. But it's certainly by no means fixed. And frankly, I've heard other people, the financing folks, describe earnings claims really is the first place the lender looks and the only place the lender can look for public information about your franchise. And they are very bullish on including earnings claim information because they think that the bank will find it relevant. So that's sort of what I see happening there. I think that, you know, I mean, look, right now people are still recovering, I think, from the economy. There may be additional litigation to come from sort of how the economy has affected certain systems. But I think it's going to come back, and I think that these service businesses are all going to come back, and I think that I actually think the future of franchising is quite bright.
Well, great. I'm glad to hear that, because I know you you definitely give it from a business perspective. You know, you mentioned about, you know, the recession and possibly some litigation coming down the pike that we could just anticipate at this point. But I know there's been a couple of franchise organizations that I've spoken with that had sold some franchises, and one of them in particular, a significant number of franchises, just prior to the economic downturn, that even today a big majority of those new franchisees have been unable to get financing and are kind of left in a very bleak position right now. Do you anticipate some type of litigation trend coming down the pike with franchisees that bought franchises anticipating that they could get financing and then didn't? Is there any type of claim or pointing fingers at the franchisor that they have a responsibility to these franchise candidates or franchisees now?
Well, you know how inventive the legal community is in terms of claims, so I'll never be the one to tell you that nobody could have a claim on anything, and I guess people could assert what they want. I don't think anybody knew what was going to happen to the economy. I don't think anybody knew what was going to happen on Wall Street or what was going to happen to the state of financing. And I think the franchisor shares the franchisee's pain in wanting to get them open and bought, because they may be qualified, they may be trained, they may be, you know, essentially ready to go, other than they can't get the cash to open. And I'm aware of some franchisors that have, you know, three-year-old agreements where they can't get the people bought. And some of those people are trying to be constructive and maybe helping people orchestrate resales. Other people are sort of extending the opening dates so that folks, as the economy improves, can go ultimately get financing. I saw some people were combining less qualified folks to try to get a qualified joint applicant. Other franchisors having to make certain, or wanting to make, or be willing to make certain accommodations to lenders in terms of taking units back if they fail and those kind of things. So,
right. Well, you mentioned a good point there about, you know, resales too. How do FPRs affect resales? Or maybe a better question is, what is the responsibility of the franchisor with respect to FPRs when it comes to the resale of an existing location?
You know, we always, the best practice, if you have a registered document in a place, you should hand it to a person, even though technically if the franchisor's only role in the resale is to approve the transferee, it really isn't a sale and wouldn't trigger disclosure requirements. The more modern view of franchisors is they want the new person to sign the, quote, then-current franchise agreement, and that's what triggers a redisclosure obligation. But I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yeah, I know because of the down economy, you know, we lost some franchisees throughout franchising, and some franchisors have actually decided to keep the locations open as company-operated units, and as the economy is turning around, will, you know, maybe look to sell those company units. And being they operated it for a relevant period of time, how does that play into FPRs? I mean, is that something they can add actual figures as a supplement to their FDD?
Yeah, so here's the deal. If you're selling a unit, or if a franchisee is selling a unit, let's do that one first. Franchisee is selling a unit, they can provide all the unit's operating history to the prospect as long as they're really a bona fide candidate for that unit, and that is frankly what you'd expect to happen. If a franchisor takes a unit back and operates that unit for a period of time, the franchisor has an operating history, obviously it can verify, and it has one from the franchisee who operated before it. There's a notice you have to give describing the limitations of the information and the fact that it was operated by a franchisee. And most of our clients would try to, you know, indicate that we didn't operate it or they didn't operate it, and that we relied on results or reporting information back from franchisees. But you have to provide certain additional information with respect to ownership of the unit when you provide that information over. But in the absence of a new franchise agreement, it wouldn't trigger any FPR issues because it wouldn't it would only be a sale if the franchisor was requiring its franchise agreement to be executed.
That's good. That cleared up a question of my own. So I got something out of this. That's great. What do you think is the future of financial performance representations, and maybe some recommendations to our franchisors moving forward?
Well, I don't think they'll ever become mandatory, but I think that people are going to become more creative in terms of the information they present. And each time we find a new industry that we're not familiar with and we try to sort of back up and take a bird's eye view, we always find new data points and information which is useful. I also think as people start to combine and they realize information is being combined about what your average sale might be and then by how many customers you have and where that information might trickle in from, that people will recognize that if you want to use any part of that, your best practice would be to include it in an FPR. So I think the adoption will become more widespread. I think that certainly in the broker networks, I think they'll approach 100%. And perhaps other more limited environments. But I think that brokers and more creative selling techniques are invented every day. There are more and more people who participate in the process. Discovery days become much more sophisticated. I think you're going to see more and more of these, and I think you're going to see more and more cases, frankly, interpreting them that say, look, it's just not reasonable to rely on this whispered number you got when you got all this very official-looking information in your FDD.
I was talking to Joe Caruso, who you know, and as everybody knows now, that helped me co-produce this legal series. We were talking this morning about master franchises, sub-franchising type of agreements. You know, I think a lot of people don't understand as a master franchisee that they have the same responsibilities as the franchisor in with respect to the FDD and with respect to earnings claims. Is that correct?
Well, I think it depends on what role the master has. If the master is as you describe it, a master, where they're essentially sub-franchising in the area, they're the franchisor. They certainly fit in the definition, and all of the relevant disclosures in terms of who their principals are, what their litigation history, all applies to them. They're required to deliver a document, wait the waiting periods, and do things like that. Now, in sort of more hybrid relationships which have emerged, like area representation or area directors, or they have other names for it, but where the contracting parties are the franchisor and franchisee and the area rep is sort of a delegate or helper in the territory, it depends really on what functions the area rep does and whether they do training and whether they, you know, what role they're going to play with respect to the prospect. Certainly to identify that there is an area rep is an important thing to note, particularly if you're going to be getting like the on-site assistance or real estate assistance from the area rep. And if the area rep was doing nothing or very little, it's possible that that it may not have relevant disclosure. I will say, though, that with the changes to the receipt, you do need to list all franchise sellers. And I believe an area rep or a master are definitely in the chain of title, if you will, of franchise sellers. And I would expect that if an area rep was involved in a sale, to see that area rep or master's name in the underlying receipt.
Absolutely. Thank you for clarifying that. You know, I know you're very involved at the IFA to the point that I don't think I could get within 30 feet of you at the recent convention as you were quite busy. And I know you're on the task force for the Franchise Business Networks. And as I said in last week's show, I had reached an agreement with Paul Rocchio and Scott Lair at the IFA, and I'll be heading up the San Antonio-Austin Franchise Business Network, and we have our first meeting in July. What do you see as the – and I know the program has changed a little bit from the second Tuesday meeting, and now it's the Franchise Business Network, and I know we have the Women's Franchise Network. Give me a little bit of insight into the future of these different IFA programs.
Well, I mean, like everything else, I think all things are going local. And not only does IFA have this FBM program and the Women's Franchise Network program, which all have certain elements to meet locally, but it now has the Franchise Congress, which it's going to be using as a lobbying tool and is using as a lobbying tool going forward. So what you're seeing is, you know, sort of bringing the the information and the opportunity and the participation to the people, recognizing that there's a much smaller subset who can travel around the country and go to national IFA events than ones who would participate locally if they had the opportunity. So in order to try to obviously create a better or more valuable member proposition, IFA has gone to these local regional meetings. And I think the FBN meetings occur in about, I'm going to say, 40 or so cities around the country on or around the same day. The hosts have some latitude in terms of whether they do a breakfast or a lunch or a dinner or whether they charge for it or don't. But I can tell you, like here in Philly, for example, we get between 80 and 100 people and get a representative from nearly every franchisor brand in the region. And you know, it's also a tool for bringing, I think, prospective members so that they can get a sense of the value that comes out of IFA. Also, with all this financing things and all the activity being on Capitol Hill, really being local activity which occurs on Capitol Hill, there's so much more need to get in front of our legislators with you know, the IFA message delivered through franchisors and franchisees that it can only be more effective. You know, it needs to be to act locally to be as effective as it can be. So I think the future is very bright for the regional meetings structure, and of course, if anybody wants to take the initiative to help develop a meeting in a place where there isn't one, or wants to know if there's one in their particular region, Paul, they should log into franchise.org and volunteer to do so.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really looking forward to it. I had been involved in the past just as a participant in the Houston area, and I'm anxious to get moving forward. We even have some interested franchisors from Mexico and South America that quite frequently come up to the San Antonio area that have already given me their commitment of participating in the meeting. So I think we're going to have a nice international flair to it as well. And I know, I think in the fall, the topic of discussion for the FBNs is international franchising. So I think it's going to come together quite nicely.
Yeah, it actually sounds like a great program, and as I was going to say to you, we are the International Franchise Association, and so I think that any international activity or participation is good. I also should say, Paul, just because of my role in IFA, that you know all the franchisors that talk to me about the complications or problems with financing or with regulation are sometimes the same ones that don't participate in IFA's lobbying activities on Capitol Hill in terms of going to D.C. for the fly-in or, frankly, participating in our FranPAC, 365, or other member donor programs. This is not a thing where you may point to the next guy and say they'll figure it out or they'll handle it, but it's a burden that really should be shared among all the interested parties and the ones that will benefit, and I encourage any folks who are not members of the 365 Club, which is just $1 a day for franchising, to get in touch with Victoria at IFA and promptly get on there.
That's a great point. Don't rely on somebody else to do it. Be as active as you can be as well. You know, I know Fisher Zucker, your firm, where you're a partner and obviously a name partner, recently took client value to new heights. You were involved in orchestrating, along with others, the Franchise Unconference in Park City, Utah. I saw some of the pictures on Facebook. I wish I could have been there. I planned on being there but had other commitments as well. Can you explain a little bit about what went on at the Franchise Unconference, and is there one scheduled for next year?
We don't have a fixed date yet, but we're going to do it again next year. It was an amazing success, Paul. We expected maybe 20 people to participate in what would in large part be a networking event with not very little programming, but programming confined to certain hours of the day, and then the object for the rest of the day being to network. And we created this amazing deck of baseball cards for each of the participants that had their, not only their photo, but their biographical information, so people could essentially get acquainted with the folks who were there before they actually got there, instead of figuring out, you know, who they were after they get home. So what it was an attempt on behalf of the host to try to identify companies that were rapidly growing, that were totally engaged in the franchise model, and that, you know, were looking to collaborate with other franchisors to try to figure out, you know, how to beat this, how to overcome the obstacles created by the economy and other things. And when to see it play out, first of all, we had close to 100 people. We had close to 45 franchise brands. And it's sort of a surreal experience to be on a ski slope with all your business contemporaries, because you're constantly changing the folks who are in your view and have different people in front or behind you in the lift line. But it was an unbelievable way for folks to get to know each other at a much higher level. And the information shared, and there's been some transactions that have come out of it. We had some big multi-unit franchisees, and I think there were some real estate transactions to come out of it. But the level of participation at the roundtables, which we orchestrated in the morning, that were hosted by or facilitated by a prominent franchisor, Charlie Chase from CertaPro Painters, were just outstanding. And the people were very, very participative and amazingly supportive of IFA's PAC. We raised a whole lot of money, but it's a thing that virtually everybody who came has already given the big thumbs up for next year, and we're just hoping we don't over, grow larger than our accommodations or obscure this very intimate networking thing that we've created.
Sure, that's great. I look forward to attending next year. Lane, it's been my pleasure and honor to have you as my guest on Franchise Today, and I certainly look forward to our future discussions together.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Remember, segments of Franchise Today are available on demand shortly after the show, along with archive segments, which may be accessed at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today. Next week, the Legal Eagle Franchise Series continues as my guest Warren Lee Lewis and I discuss franchise sales best practices. Until then, I'm Paul Segreto. Thanks for listening to Franchise Today. Have a great day, and more importantly, please be safe.